All right, welcome to the Chronic Podcast. I'm your host, Ralph Marlborough. It's the off season, but God damn it, we still got to talk Saints football, and there's only 1 week of football left with the Super Bowl, so what else are we going to do? As always, we're joined by Andrew Juge of thesaintsnation.com. Andrew, I would like to, along with all Saints fans and you, congratulate the Atlanta Falcons for blowing the biggest lead in the history of the NFC Championship game. They're winning 17-0, and they coughed it up and lost 28-24. You know, and part of me wants to bang on them for all sorts of, you know, Mike Smith can't coach, he can't adjust. But part of me is thinking, oh my God, if Harry Douglas doesn't fall down, we have an Atlanta-Baltimore Super Bowl.
Well, that wasn't even a catch, Ralph. That wasn't even a catch. Like, how did they uphold that as a catch? The football clearly hits the field, the turf, and then comes loose.
Well, I mean, you're right about that. But what I'm saying is, if he doesn't just fall down for no apparent reason, he's wide open. He's walking in.
Yeah, true.
The strange thing about that game was I thought Matt Ryan was superb the first half, but Atlanta couldn't make adjustments. And I'm starting to think, like, Mike Smith is like Jim Mora and Marty Schottenheimer 2.0. Like, he's a really good coach in the fact that he's won a ton of games, and you can't knock him and say he's no good. But he just can't get Atlanta over the hump in the playoffs. And I don't see how you can look at Atlanta and say, oh, they're young, they're going to get better. I mean, you could say that about Seattle maybe or Washington. But Atlanta, this is their bunch, and they're not going to make a bunch of changes to it. I mean, they are kind of what they are.
Yeah, I mean, Michael Turner's on his last leg. John Abraham's on his last leg. Tony Gonzalez is probably done. So they've got some older players, but I think the main thing to take away from this is Atlanta's been playing like this all season, Ralph, where at times they've had big leads, at times they've come back, but they've always let their opponents kind of hang around. And that's been their MO all season. And frankly, it's remarkable they won as many games as they did because they really came down as numerous nail-biters. And I just think when it was a perfect combination of sometimes they weren't putting teams away, other times they'd get in a big hole early. But by and large, the Falcons' way of winning this year was to basically lay down and eat clock for the majority of second halves and count on Matt Ryan to make something happen in the last minute of the game. And, you know, I have to give him kudos. I mean, a lot like Eli Manning a couple years ago and last year, a few years ago and last year, I mean, he was excellent all year in the two-minute offense and really was one of the best in the league, if not the best, at handling those game-type situations. And it really got them a lot of nail-biting wins. But that's the thing. You know, you play enough times like that. You know, that's the thing about the Saints, man. When they won the Super Bowl in 2009, they got a 17-0 lead on you, and it was over. Forget it. You know, you're done. You get down 3 scores to that offense, it was over. You had no chance. But no, the Falcons haven't made any team feel like that. And they keep playing teams hanging around, and eventually, Ralph, that's going to come back to bite you. You know, Matt Ryan's not going to be able to pull off every time. And, you know, in that game, he injured his shoulder pretty badly. It was visible. He could barely hold his arm up. And that final drive, he was playing with one arm, you know, his throwing arm, but I definitely think it affected his accuracy, particularly on that last ball to Tony Gonzalez, which was right way behind him.
Yeah, I mean, and people were like, well, it's his left shoulder. Dude, if his left shoulder, say it's separated or whatever, that's an incredible amount of pain to try to take that snap and try to focus on what you need to do.
That's the thing where it's tough on quarterbacks. You've been the starter all year. You started the game. You want to finish it. But at some point, you got to take yourself out. You know, if you're hurt, I mean, in RG3 is the same thing. You know, these quarterbacks are stubborn. But if your guy's hurt, you know, the pickups, you know, with time, they can make accurate throws. And if they're healthy, you got to think about making that change. He's fortunate he didn't take a hit. You know, we talked about that RG3 game and how everyone in the stadium and outside the stadium saw what happened to RG3 coming. You know, before he had that injury, we all knew it was coming. It was just a matter of when. Because he was playing on one leg and he was only going to make it worse. But Matt Ryan's lucky he didn't take a huge hit on that Hail Mary pass because he dropped his shoulder into the ground one more time. And, you know, maybe he's starting the season on PUP next year instead of, you know, a four-week recovery.
Yeah, and the thing about it, you know, everybody's like, well, San Francisco went to the NFC Championship game and lost, and they got back this year, so maybe Atlanta can do the same. But to me, Atlanta is an older team, like the Saints are, so that could be a problem for the Saints as well. But to me, Atlanta was a 10-win team that won 13 games because they won all the close games, and that just doesn't break your way every year. And
well, I'd like to see who they draft, you know, who they pick up in the offseason. I mean, you know, obviously, I think there's going to be some changes to their lineup. So, you know, before I make any decisions on what I think they're going to be like, I'd like to see the roster changes. But I think it was kind of a perfect storm for Atlanta. And, you know, and obviously I'm biased. Ralph, you know I despise them. I probably hate the Falcons more than your average Saints fan. So, you know, it's not healthy for me to talk about them too much. But I will say this, and this is not me being biased. I mean, this is statistically proven that they were pretty much the worst one seed in NFL history in terms of how they were winning games. You know, how they were dominating games, yards per play, turnover battle, time of possession, all that stuff, yards per carry, how they were doing against the run. Statistically, they were not a very good team. And so it was almost like an anomaly that they were able to win so many games. So I think this year Atlanta was kind of like a perfect storm for them. And I'm, by no means am I not saying that they're not a good team, but they felt more like a 10-6 team.
Yeah.
Then a 13-3 team, and on it, you know, if they had to go to Seattle or if they had to go to San Francisco, they would have gotten beaten a lot worse, probably by both teams.
Well,
but, I was just gonna say, I don't think they can maintain winning 13-16 games in a regular season, playing like that. So they're gonna have to get better.
Well, and here's the thing for Atlanta, which this I love to twist the knife on Atlanta fans. I mean, and Andrew, the last 3 years, Atlanta has won 37 games. And their last 3 years have been, regular seasons have been as good as the Saints' previous three, where the Saints went 13-3, 11-5, 13-3. The difference is the Saints won four playoff games and a Super Bowl. Atlanta has one playoff win in that time. And you know, the thing is, it becomes harder for a fan base. And look, the Saints, we'd be in the same position if the Saints hadn't won a Super Bowl. Is you get to the point where the regular season is just, it's people just, they're like, whatever, whatever, whatever. And all it comes down to is, can you win in the playoffs? Can you win in the playoffs? And the thing is, Andrew, it really wears on the fan base because you don't enjoy the regular season because all you define it by is playoff success. And now, look, the Saints, was the defeat last year to San Francisco horrible? Yeah, but at least we didn't have the guillotine hanging over us of we've never won a playoff game, we've never won a Super Bowl, and the golden years of the Saints are getting flushed down the toilet. And I think it's just going to weigh on Atlanta more in 2013.
Well, Ralph, I mean, it's a carbon copy of the Saints in the Jim Moore era. I mean, we lived through this. I mean,
yeah.
You and I grew up as kids where those Jim Moore teams were fantastic, and they had some seasons, you know, that playoff loss to the Falcons and the playoff loss to the Eagles where we really felt like, you know, besides San Francisco, who was clearly the best team, you know, we at least had a great show at the NFC Championship, you know, and at worst, that's where the Saints belonged. And they couldn't win in playoff games. And so that's what we grew up with as youngsters, and it you remember as well as I do, it wore on the fan base big time.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and I think for some of our younger fans, you know, they think, oh, the dome's the loudest, and you know, the Saints fans are the best. That's absolutely true. But it hasn't always been like that. I think you can say, you know, the Saints fans have put up over the years with a lot of shit, and so the fact that they've stuck around is impressive. But before Katrina, they weren't selling out games. You know, a lot of times, I mean, you remember, like, some of those games in the 90s when they were even going to the playoffs, some of the 50 years, they were having to, it was blacked out until the last second. Like, it was blacked out, like, where you couldn't even watch it on TV, and sometimes they would sell enough tickets on the last day for the game to the blackout to be lifted and you could watch it on TV, and sometimes it wasn't. And so, you know, you had to listen to WWL if you weren't in the stadium because you weren't going to get to watch it. So, Saints fans, I mean, have always been passionate, but I would not say that they have always been the greatest fans in the NFL. And, you know, fortunately for me, and I think, Ralph, maybe you're like me, I was young enough during the Jim Mora era that I didn't put up with all the shit that preceded it. And so because of that, I was hopeful. You know, the old Saints fans, my parents, my uncles, my aunts, my grandparents, you know, and my parents' friends, that, you know, there was very much this attitude of same old Saints, same old Saints. You know, they're just going to blow it again, and they would always call them the Aints. And after a while, you know, as a young fan, you know, I didn't have that memory. So I was like, no, they're going to do it this year. And I was real positive. And they would blow it. And then it was just like, once that happened, the fan base would pile on. Like, same old Saints, we love them, but they're losers. And after a while, like, as a kid, that starts to weigh on you. You're growing up in this era, and all these, you know, your previous generation is telling you that your team is shit. And, they might pick it up a little bit in the regular season, but they're never going to get it done in the playoffs. And after a while, I started to get that same attitude.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean,
it is. I think the Falcons are right in the thick of that, just feeling that exact same way right now.
Well, I think that is completely true. And look, you know, if the Saints had blown that playoff game against the Rams when Akeem drops the ball, I mean, that would have set the Saints back a decade, because the Saints winning that game 31-7 with about 8 minutes to go, and it nearly burned to the ground. And if Akeem doesn't fumble, it would have burned to the ground. You know,
I was at that game, Ralph, and when the Rams started making that comeback, you could hear a pin drop in the Superdome, because every fan in there was just saying, "Oh crap, here we go again."
Yeah, and that was as we go with Saints Wayback Machine. That was a thing where the Saints, I think they lost two corners in that game, so they literally were like out of people to cover at the Rams at the time, who were the greatest show on turf. Like, the Saints were just literally out of players, and the only thing that saved them was a fumble and the clock.
And Brian Milne.
So I mean, it you know, you get to that point, and you know, to me, with Drew Brees, I just don't have that feeling. I mean, that's why the Kansas City game this year was just one of those things. You're like, what the fuck? They were, you know, you're getting ready to turn on the Red Zone channel and enjoy a leisurely Sunday, and they just gacked it up, which really, it hadn't happened during the Sean Payton era, but we'll see. I don't want to spend this podcast.
You just had to bring up the Kansas City.
I know,
game.
I did.
God damn it.
But, you know, well, I was talking about Atlanta, but this is something that me and Andrew emailed and talked a little bit about. We talked about it before the podcast started, and we emailed back and forth today. Andrew wants to go off about the just horrific coaching gaffes, clock management. Atlanta was terrible at it. New England, Tom Brady, who's usually really good at it, he was terrible at it yesterday. San Francisco did something that Andrew wants to talk about at the end of the game. But what the hell, Andrew, is going on with these teams, and they're just – the clock management is just piss poor, and it's not bad teams. It's not like Andy Reid and Romeo Crennel. It's Drew Brees and Tom Brady. I mean, what the hell is going on with these teams and the clock management?
I don't know, Ralph. I don't know if it's poor management or maybe there's something to be said with all these blows to the head starting to take their toll. You know, some of these aging veterans making these mistakes, but. You know, countless examples that we can list. You know, with, you just mentioned the Brees botch. The Saints had another opportunity earlier this year where there was about a minute left in the half, and Joe Vitt could have called a timeout, but instead of calling a timeout, he let the other team run the clock all the way down to 3 seconds and kick the field goal before halftime. It was like, why wouldn't you give the football to the best offense in NFL history for a chance to at least get a field goal, you know, before halftime? And, you know, we've seen it countless times with Les Miles this season, and we've seen just numerous things from numerous coaches, and in the NFL especially, that I just don't understand. But anyway, what really set me over the edge, Ralph, yesterday, was the Falcons and the 49ers. Now, granted, once the 49ers got the ball back, I was severely on edge because I'm screaming at my TV, for the love of God, 49ers, finish them off. Do not let Matt Ryan back in this thing. Do not let the Falcons get the ball back. And, of course, they let him get the ball back. But what set me over the edge, Ralph, was there was about a minute left, and the Falcons had two timeouts. So, you know, worst absolute case scenario, you get them the ball back with about 15 to 20 seconds left with no timeouts. Worst case scenario. So that is what happened. But they were running out of the shotgun. They were handing off out of the shotgun. I do not understand why they didn't put their quarterback under center. Why would you take that risk, Ralph? Have we not learned anything from Matt Ryan earlier in the game having a shotgun snap hit right in the middle of his chest and dropping the football for a costly fumble that pretty much blew the game for them? And there was just so much that could go wrong. The center could snap it over the quarterback's hand. You've got a quarterback that's pretty much a rookie. I'm pretty sure he's shitting his pants in that situation because he's never even been in a playoff game, and all of a sudden it rests on him catching a shotgun snap with the entire stadium going screaming at him. And he could drop the football just like Matt Ryan did earlier in the game. And this is just situational awareness, Ralph. I mean, it's just football 101. And this year, more than any other year, and I don't understand why, these teams are just making stupid decisions. And it just makes no sense to me that a team would go out of the shotgun for a handoff. I mean, just go out of the eye, classic handoff, put two hands on the ball, fall down for a one-yard gain, and let them burn all their timeouts, run the clock down to 15 seconds and punt. And they're so lucky that something didn't go wrong. It baffles me, Ralph, that
we've seen
it time and time again this year.
Well, the thing that baffles me, just at the end of the game, if you're a team and you have decided, look, we're in a second and long and third and long, and they are out of timeouts, and we're really not trying to get the first down, why not just line up in victory formation? Even if you're going to have to punt at the end, and I know you say, well, we could break a long run and pick up the first down. Yeah, maybe you could on second and 15, but the more likely is you're not. So just run victory formation. So even if you have a screw-up, it's a giant pig pile, and at least your guy can be at the bottom of it. I just think teams aren't getting better at figuring out the clock. Teams are getting worse. I feel that way. And
ooh.
I mean, you know, and to me, it was really apparent that a lot of the clock, I always just kind of assumed with the Saints that the clock management was just Breeze was so sharp, and he is, but I thought it was like 80% him and just like 20 to 30% Sean Payton. I don't think so. I think it's like probably 60% Breeze or 65% Breeze and like 35% Payton with the clock management and stuff at the end of the games. I really think that, and it showed up this year, you know?
Well, if you're the Saints and you're LSU, you know, I think those are the two teams that I watched the most, Ralph. But,
yeah.
And I've seen some glaring mistakes from those two this year. And certainly there's been
other teams. To be fair, Andrew, Les Miles, he doesn't even realize that football is a time sport. So,
right, very true. I mean, clearly he's got a long laundry list and track record with this stuff. But I think, you know, in college, there's less liberty for the players. You know, I think it's more on the coaches because they don't give the players on the field the ability to read defenses and call audibles and manage the line scrimmage. I mean, it's really the coaches are directing everything. So that falls more on Les Miles. In the NFL, they give a lot of rope to the players, and especially players like Drew Brees. So I think in the NFL, it's a little bit more on a guy like Drew Brees to handle that situation appropriately. But I think at the end of the day, these things are so obvious, Ralph. I think some of these guys have taken for granted their knowledge of situational football. And I've seen enough times over the course of this year, people botching the most obvious football situations that I think it would behoove them in the offseason to really brush up on this stuff. And it may seem obvious, but, okay, situational football. There's 2 minutes left, you know, so you know they're going to get a two-minute warning to stop the clock, and they have one timeout. How does that affect your play calling? You know, what do you do? You know, once it's third down, do you run and run the clock all the way down to 30 seconds, or do you throw and try to pick up the first down? Those are things that you need to be thinking about and that you need to be prepared for in the offseason. If I'm Sean Payton, I'm looking at these mistakes, and I'm not taking for granted that even though these football players probably know this stuff and should know it, that's the kind of finer details that I think are important and help you win games, because we've talked about the countless times the margin in these games is so small that it's really fine-tuning and preparing your team and your players for those situations. If you handle them properly, you're not going to have some of these massive mistakes that end up costing you.
Yeah, I mean, just the clock management things, I think Bill Belichick has really, he's the best at it and game situations and that sort of thing. But it's just simple things that I think a lot of people take for granted, just that conventional wisdom that isn't so. You know, it's one of the people I like is Michael Lombardi, and he talks about clock management. He says one of the things that drives him nuts is a team, say, right before the two-minute warning, will take a timeout with like 2:05 left, and, you know, people will think, well, that's good because that makes them run another play before the two-minute warning. But he says that's bad because what happens is if a team has a third down and it's 2:05 on the clock, they can do whatever they want because they know the clock is going to stop at the two-minute warning. If you hold your timeout and you wait until the two-minute warning comes and then they have a third down, well, then they have to make a decision. Well, if we throw it and we don't complete it, the clock stops. Or do we run it and try to burn more clock and make them use the timeout? He's just like, people don't really study the clock and all the scenarios and don't know how to make it work. And I think it's true. I mean, I think if you just look at certain coaches that have been, I mean, like Andy Reid, he's really successful, but he's horrible at doing the clock. Lovie Smith is horrible at doing the clock. Now, you
North
can make
Turner.
North Turner. You can make the argument, look, of all the things that a coach needs to do, fans, we obsess over can they get the clock right and this and that. And it's really, it's not on the list of things you would want of a head coach. It's not that high on the list, I don't think. But it's one of those things like, how can you not, if you could be a coach and you can be brilliant and you can lead men and you can get them to win 9 to 12 games a year, how can you not know how to manage the clock?
Well, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head there, Ralph. I think it's down on the list in terms of, you know, what do you want out of your head coach? Is he a good leader? Is he a good teacher? Is he a good manager of personalities? Is he a good adjustment, you know, person? Is he good at making decisions on the fly? You know, I mean, you know, those are all characteristics that I think you want in a head coach, more so than being, is he a good recruiter? You know, is he a good salesman? I think those are all things that are more important than, and does he manage time well? You know, so, but unfortunately, for some of these guys, they're so good at the other stuff that the teams hire them at the expense of them not being good time clock managers. But I'll say this: it blows my mind, Ralph, that I truly believe I am more advanced in that category only in terms of just knowledge of situational football and knowledge of what you do with the clock and where it is and what you should do in given situations. The fact that I feel like I am mentally more advanced in that category only over numerous head coaches in the NFL is a scary thought, because I don't think that highly of myself, you know, in terms of my football.
Well,
I'd like to think 99% of these coaches are better than me at 99% of everything. But the fact that I consider myself at least better than a couple of these coaches at anything is kind of that doesn't speak well of me. That means it's really scary.
Well, the thing I think it is I think it's a combination of there's so much chaos on the sideline. The clock becomes one of those things that in all the chaos, if you've ever been on the sideline for even a high school game, the chaos on the sideline can be quite interesting if you're not used to it. I think NFL teams should seriously look at, they have 900 assistant coaches anyway, have a guy that's the clock coordinator, and when it's the end of the game, the coach clicks the button, and instead of talking to the offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator, whoever, he talks to the clock coordinator and says, clock coordinator, what do we do? And that's the guy's job. He says, coach, there's a minute and a half left. It's second down. You need to call timeout. You need to not call timeout. You know, just, I don't understand why they don't do that. I mean, hell, they have coaches now. All they do is their job is to look at the replay and tell the coach whether to challenge or not. I mean, so if you can.
I think it's a great call. I think it's a great call, Ralph, because there's so much parity in the NFL. I mean, if you look at any of these teams that are top seed in their conference, and look how many games they had that were 7 points or less, you know, one score, you know, and you know that basically the entire game was hanging in the balance of the final drive, you know, and teams, let's say they go 13-3 like the Falcons. How many times this year did they have a game come down the wire? I would say of their 16 games, I would say at least 11 or 12 of them.
Yeah.
You know, and you know what that means, Ralph? Instead of being 13-3, they easily could have been 6-10 if they just had the worst luck. So based on that, I think making a hire like that would be very smart.
You know,
and I swear, when I think you have a guy that studies all these situations where he knows everything, and it would help your team not blow it. Because, I mean, listen, some of these games are so close that sometimes the difference between being having a incredibly high football IQ and being an idiot is the difference between a win and one person.
And here's what I think a team will eventually do. It might be the Patriots. It might be somebody else. Eventually, teams are going – and football, they're starting to do it a little bit, I think. And I think a team like the Saints, just listening to Joe Vitt with all the statistics that he uses, I think actually the Saints are one of those teams that starting to look at the advanced football statistics. And I think eventually one of these teams, Andrew, is going to hire a guy from Pro Football Focus or Football Outsiders, and they're going to say, hey, give us – just keep doing your advanced statistic work that you do, but also all this research that you've done on clock management, on game day, you're going to be up in the press box, and that's going to be your job. We're going to call you football analyst nerd guy, and we're going to pay you – you know, and we're going to pay you – you're going to start out, you're not going to, you know, they probably won't have to pay them anything. We're going to pay you $35,000 a year. You're going to be a football analyst during the week, and on Sunday, you're going to be clock management guy. And I think what's going to happen is one or two teams are going to start doing it, and it's going to, you know, but it's going to take sort of a coach that doesn't have an ego that says, you know what, I'm going to farm out doing the clock because I've got so many other things to do. I think it's like a macho things with coaches. They don't want to admit, yeah, I've got 900 things going in my brain, and I can't do the clock too. So it's a macho thing. I think it's going to take a coach to sort of step out on the ledge and say, yeah, I've got a football nerd. He's 30. He's a virgin, and we have him in the press box, but he's awesome with the clock, and I go to him. And
yeah, I know. I mean, Haslett was the worst at that.
Yeah.
Having this attitude of, you know, well, obviously you know better than me. I'm just a football coach, and you're a fan, and you're a media member, so – and he always had this kind of crass attitude, like, you know, this, you know, attitude of, you know, I'm a football coach, and, you know, you would be in the NFL too if you knew better than me. So everything I say is absolute, you know. And so, yeah, basically absolving himself of ever being wrong or ever being questioned because we're inferior minds or something. But, no, I definitely think there is a mentality, especially in a brute sport like football, where there's this macho thing where you can't admit that you make mistakes, and you can't admit that, you know, some guy might not be better than you at something. So,
yeah.
I agree with you. I mean, it's already infiltrated the NBA. You know, advanced statistics
yep.
are a major thing in that sport, and it's, you know, it's a Bible to some teams have adopted it so much so that it's a Bible. I mean, you look at Billy Beane in Oakland,
their whole philosophy, they don't care about players at all. And, you know, there's no, the human element has been almost completely removed in Oakland. And those guys are just about stats crunching and numbers and advanced statistics. So football, I say it's a little bit in the dark ages or in the stone ages in terms of coming into a new age of technology in terms of, and the fans have embraced it. I mean, you look at fantasy football and all this stuff, the fans are kind of more new age. And I think the game still stays a little barbaric, and it's still, a lot of it is based on feel and gut. And the advanced stats that, you know, you look at PFF and what's the other website we always
Football Outsiders.
Yeah, Football Outsiders. Like, that hasn't really infiltrated the game in front offices and, you know, the GMs as much as it has in baseball and basketball. But at some point in the near future, I think you may make a very astute and smart comment to say that it's going to come. And I'm surprised, Ralph, that it hasn't come yet.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things I like about Sean Payton is that I think he embraces it to a certain extent. And then look, Sean, all great coaches, Bill Belichick, they're all arrogant. And if you try to tell them, you know, they're wrong, they're going to push back against the media. It's just their instinct. But I will say one thing about Sean Payton is, you know, about 4 years ago, he was like, I suck when I challenge, when I throw my flag. Why do I suck when I throw my flag? And he looked at it, and they analyzed it. And to a certain extent, especially the last 3 years, he's fixed it, and he's a lot better at it. You know.
Yeah, well, I mentioned Hazlitt, Ralph, and one of the things that I couldn't stand about Hazlitt was that he was so hard-headed, he was never willing to admit he was wrong. And, you know, the Jake Delhomme and Aaron Brooks situation was a perfect example of that. But you're absolutely right. Sean Payton has always been willing to look at himself, self-scout, and say, you know what, I was wrong. This is a bad decision. And so, okay, you know, and he digs deeper. Why was this a mistake? And let's correct it and let's improve. And I think you've got to be successful in the NFL as a coach, you have to have that mentality. The minute you start thinking, you know, it's kind of like the attitude that Brees has. If you read his book, he says, you're always getting better, you're getting worse, you're never staying the same. And head coach has to have that attitude too. And I can promise you that Jim Harris would never have that attitude.
Yeah, and I think, look, teams are always going to, whatever you did the year before that was awesome, teams will always look at video in the offseason and try to fix it. Speaking of coaches with the Saints, they're trying to get Carmichael an extension. I think that's probably going to happen. Cromer's gone, you know, and, you know, the Saints, I know that I read on WWL, Bradley Handwerker said, look, you know, we're not worried about it and this and that. But to me, Andrew, it's so screws them because Sean Payton very well may be sitting out there saying, I want this guy, but he can't contact the Saints to say, go get, you know, say it's Tony Sparano. He can't contact Mickey Loomis and say, or Joe Vitt and say, go hire Tony Sparano. I know him. I don't need to be there in the interviews. Go do it. He can't do that because that would, you know, he can't talk to the Saints. And he can't talk to Sparano. Well, maybe he could because Sparano's fired. I don't know. Maybe he could talk to Sparano and say, why don't you call
him? No, Payton's not allowed to talk to anyone that's affiliated with the NFL, whether they're in it or not. You know, because remember, when Brees was technically not under contract, there was this whole thing like, are Brees and Payton talking?
Yeah, that's right.
But no, he's not allowed to talk to anyone that's affiliated with the NFL,
so
period.
Yeah.
He is allowed to talk to Benson. That's the one thing that's come out is that he has been allowed to talk to Benson throughout. So based on that, I mean, maybe he could, you know, flip something to Benson and Benson could say, okay, go hire this guy.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, I mean, look, let's not kid ourselves. He may not be able to directly contact people, but I'm sure if he really has a guy in mind that is, especially like Sparano, where like they have a history together, I'm sure Sean Payton can get a message to him and be like, Tony, wait a week. You know? And it's not coming directly from him. It's coming from his agent or whoever, You know, so I still think that's who it's going to be. It's going to be Sparano because he ran a running game. He did it in Dallas. He was offensive assistant, charge of the running game. I mean, it's just Sean Payton wanted to bring him here. I think that'll be a good fit. I'll tell you
what worries me about that situation, Ralph. Is
what's that?
I think if all the starters are coming back, it's fine. If the Saints lose Bushra, then I start to get a little bit more concerned about Cromer because I don't think the starting left tackle on this team is on the roster right now.
Yeah.
And so losing Cromer, I think, becomes a bigger blow if they've got a new player that he developed at that position.
Well, that's the case. And I look, if Bushrod leaves, which I think it's like 50-50, Andrew, and look, I know we go back and forth, Bushrod. People who listen to this podcast are probably like, Jesus, they're talking about Bushrod again. But as of today, Andrew, when I was driving home today, I thought of all the team that needed a tackle because I was listening to NFL and Sirius. All the teams that need a tackle, Kansas City, Chicago, where Aaron Cromer's going, Jacksonville,
Philly.
Buffalo needs a tackle, the Raiders, San Diego could use one. I mean, you got at least six. Like he's getting a big contract. I think the Saints are going to have to pay him about, if they're going to keep him, they're going to have to pay him about $7 million a year, $8 million a year. And I don't know if the Saints are going to go there, Andrew. So I think it's 50-50 at best that he's back.
Yeah, and Ralph, I think him making the Pro Bowl is bad for the Saints. As crazy as that sounds. He got in thanks to the Falcons losing. So Jess Bailey of the 49ers was supposed to go, and now that he's headed to the Super Bowl, Bushrod gets the call up to the Pro Bowl. So I actually think that hurts the Saints because remember when he was entering free agency at the time, he was kind of arriving – player that people didn't really know, and they were like, yeah, he's a decent left tackle, but, you know, the Saints offered him a decent two-year deal, and it was a lockout, so we don't really know how that affected teams financially and everything. So the Saints were fortunate to get him back, but this year, since then, he's been to two Pro Bowls now, and I do think teams, not every front office is created equal. Some aren't very smart, and some are pretty desperate, like you said, for tackles. And I think when you're an agent and you're trying to convince teams to sign your client, those are good buzzwords to have. And when he was entering free agency last time, he didn't have the buzzword. He's entering it now with a guy saying, look, this is a two-time Pro Bowl left tackle for a Super Bowl champion. Show me the money.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that commands more respect and potentially more money than last time he was entering free agency.
And look, you know, another team that needs a tackle if Bushrod wants to maybe get paid and stay with a team that can win, Green Bay, their offensive line's terrible. Aaron Rodgers got the snot kicked out of him in the playoff game against San Francisco, and if he wasn't so mobile, their offensive line would look worse. So they're a team that you could throw in the mix. That needs a tackle. So the more I think about it, I think it's 50-50 at best, which then, Andrew, if Bushrod leaves, then you know, we'll get into this later as the offseason goes along, but then the draft is just chaos because then you have a gaping need that is of utmost importance, Drew Brees' blind side, where everything in the draft changes, and if the Saints don't get the second-round pick back, then they're really in a bind. So the whole Bushrod situation is, to me, it's not maybe, you know, as last offseason where they had a bunch of people, but to me, if Bushrod leaves, it can be a domino process where Bushrod leaves, then they might have to pick a tackle, and then you don't have a second round pick, and then we look up after the draft, Andrew, and we're like, man, the defense isn't that much better. They haven't really added anybody. You know,
Ralph, I think the situation is going to set up exactly like the Promenix one, where the Saints are going to have, you know, Lims is going to crunch his numbers and he's going to say, okay, this is what we can offer Bushrod, and this is what he's worth to our team. And then the question will become, they're not going to pay him $7 million. I just don't think that they're going to pay him that much. So the question becomes $7 million a year. So the question becomes, is he going to give the Saints a hometown discount or is he going to leave like Mets did for more money? And so I think it will come down to that. And I really do believe that Bushrod is a little bit less money hungry, and I think he's a little bit more loyal of a guy than Carl Nix. But
yeah, but is he
–
Carl Nix got ridiculous – Carl Nix got ridiculous money, though.
Yeah, he did. He did. Yeah, he's not going to get Carl Nix-type money, but I still think someone will come in and offer him more money than the Saints are. So the question will become, does he give the Saints a hometown discount, or does he leave? And if he leaves, I think we'll see a similar situation in the Ben Grubb situation, where the Saints will then look at the next best tackle available, and they will say, all right, you know what, we were willing to give this to Bushrod, and so now we're willing to give it to you as the best tackle in free agency, and, you know, we'll replace it with another solid, capable player in free agency and give them the same contract they would have given Bushrod. So I think that's how it'll play out. You know, and I agree with you. I think it's 50-50 whether Bushrod just takes what they offer or if they end up giving the same deal they offer Bushrod to the next best tackle in free agency.
Yeah, I mean it'll be really, really interesting to see what happens because they have teams with a ton of money, and look, the Saints they did fine with Ben Grubbs. I mean is he Carl Nix? No, but he got half as much guaranteed money. So
he was a very solid player this year. Very
yeah.
Solid.
You know, and the thing is though, I mean they have I mean you look you could go I mean they have Jake Long is a free agent. He's injured. He was injured with Miami. You have Ryan Clady for Denver. You have Brandon Albert for Kansas City. Vollmer for New England. Andre Smith. So I mean, there are some guys out there
you
that.
You can't miss me that Bushrod may not get traded the deal.
What's that? Well,
I
mean,
all these names you're throwing out there. I think these guys are all better than Bushrod.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is though, I mean, if you're the Saints. Do you say, you know what, Bushrod, you can get, you know, we know that you can get $8 million from Chicago, but if you're the Saints, do you like, you know what, we're going to get Sebastian Vollmer for New England for $5 million, and we only have to guarantee him $10 million. You know, I mean,
right.
And the thing is, the Saints are still a destination where they do not, they had to overpay Breeze, but they can still get the guys at their price because a player like Vollmer, if he gets offered from, let's say, Jacksonville or the Saints, and it's the same offer, he's coming to the Saints. Whereas,
yeah.
You know, with Haslett or whatever, they had to overpay. The Saints don't have to now. They can say, look, Vollmer, you really want to go to Jacksonville? No, you don't. Come here. And they'll get that. So the Bushrod thing will be very, very interesting. I think you're right, you know, because it's absolutely critical, Andrew, because I just from what I see with Goodell, I don't think they're getting the second round pick back. For one, Goodell is just being a dick about the whole thing, and two, I hear that he saw the Crew de Vue parade and he saw the floats of Roger Goodell fucking a dog, Roger Goodell climbing out of a vagina, and he got upset, and the Saints aren't getting the second-round pick back, Andrew. They're just not.
Well, he was pretty vindictive, so it wouldn't surprise me in the least. By the way, how great was Scott Shanley trolling the Falcon fans on Twitter last night? Did you catch that?
I did. I caught the first photo of the Super Bowl ring and the subsequent about 8 of them where it was game balls, and it was the specific game balls that he got when they played Atlanta. And it just made me love and appreciate Scott Shanley even more. And I know he caught a lot of crap from Saints fans, but let me tell you, Saints fans, the Saints in 2006, you forget because it's a long time ago, but their linebacking core was atrocious.
Mm-hmm.
And they got Scott Shanley for a po' boy and a six-pack of Dixie beer. And their linebacking core, because of him and Fujita, went from atrocious to average, which was, at the time, a humongous upgrade. And not only that, they got 7 freaking years out of Shanley.
starting years. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was highly entertaining, Ralph, because you know, if you actually went on his timeline, you could read his responses. Yeah, you can just see it in your own feed. You have to go to the timeline, but he was responding to everyone. So all these Falcons fans that were talking trash to him would respond to him, and you know, he would post something like, "All right, here's statistically, here's something you know that talks about my career." And then he said, but warning, you have to read. You know, you have to be able to read in order to understand it. So basically he was taking a jab at Falcons fans that they're all illiterate. And one Falcons fan that specifically said, how funny is it going to be when the Saints trade your ass next year to the Falcons? And his response to that person was, I would never play for the Falcons. I would retire first. He's just like brutal. But I mean, he just had some awesome comebacks to some of these people, and some of them, you know, would just write the most classic Atlanta fan would just write the most nonsensical insults to him, and you know, he would just be like, you know, stay classy, Atlanta, you know, classic response from a Falcon fan, you know, and just jabbing at them on being illiterate, and I mean, he was clearly bored and going all out on just messing with Falcons fans and kicking them while they were down. And, he was just awesome. It's basically what the Angry Hoot At does on a daily basis. And Scott Chanley just decided, you know what, I'm going to be the Angry Hoot At for about 3 hours here and really, you know, stoke the fire, you know, while the fans are pissed that they just lost. So, as much as I hate the Falcons, it's so great to see a player feel the same way. I mean, that is just awesome.
Well, and look, I mean, we're going to have this debate, and you might think I'm crazy, but I'm going to tell you something. I think Scott Chanley is a borderline Saints Hall of Famer. I look at him, and you look at some of the people that are in there for the Saints, like Joe Federspiel, and I mean, you know, I think you can make a case for him being in the Hall of Fame. You can make the case.
Is Hobie Brenner a Saints Hall of Famer?
Oh, I don't know. That's a good. I think he might be.
I kind of feel like he's along those lines. Like, not quite as good as Stan Brock, but he's had a career kind of like a Hobie Brenner, where Hobie Brenner put in a good workmanlike 10 years. I mean, longevity wise, you know, especially in this day and age, Chanley has lasted forever with the Saints, and he's put in some solid years. So he kind of had a Hobie Brenner-esque career with the Saints, where he just always showed up to work. He was always the starter. The Saints brought in John Tice. They brought in all these people to try to beat Hobie Brenner out, and he just kept being the starter. And it was just like that with Chanley. You know, they brought in Dan Morgan.
Yeah.
And they brought in who's that linebacker? Clint Ingram.
Yeah.
They brought him, and he couldn't cut it.
Yeah.
And they brought in all these free agents and rookies and draft guys and to get out of Chanley, and Chanley withstood everything they threw at him. They're like, no, I'm still the starter. And
look,
this is the first year finally with the Hawthorne and, you know, Vilma coming back from injury and Lofton that he's kind of been at the side. But even at the beginning of this year, he was still the starter, even with that. So
yeah, and look, if Jim Wilkes is in the Hall of Fame for the Saints, I love Jim. Jim Wilkes is one of my favorite guys. He played for like 10 years.
Great. Frank Warren and Wilkes, both
yeah,
of those guys.
Didn't go to the Pro Bowl, but just work. I mean, look, I'm not saying he's a lock, but I'm saying that he's a guy that it wouldn't stun me if he gets in the Saints Hall of Fame. And I think he's one of those guys that, you know, he's caught a lot of crap from fans, but you know, if the Saints could draft a player that was just one level better than Scott Chanley, if I told you, Andrew, the Saints will draft a player that's 15% better than Scott Chanley was at his peak with the Saints, they'll draft that player in the second round, or you can have what's behind door number two. What would you take?
Oh, I would say if you can do it to me that, I would say who do I have to blow?
So, I mean, you know, Andrew, before we let you go, because we probably won't talk to you before the Super Bowl, who do you like? and who are you rooting for? I, unfortunately, am rooting for San Francisco because in Vegas I bet them when they were 9-2 odds. So I win about $200 if they win the Super Bowl. So I'm rooting for San Francisco, and I hate the murdering Ray Lewis. So that's what I'll be rooting for San Francisco, and I think they'll win. But what about you? What do you think will happen, and who will you be pulling for?
Well, this is brutal. This is brutal for me because I do feel slightly indebted to the 49ers for taking out the Falcons. I mean, I tweeted this. You know, Vernon Davis is absolved of his past sins against the Saints in the playoffs based on what he did to the Falcons, and just make sure they came nowhere near New Orleans. So I feel a little indebted. And, Jonathan Goodwin is, I mean, honestly one of my favorite players in the NFL, just a great dude, former Saint. And so it would be great to see him win another title, but can't stand Frank Gore, can't stand Harbaugh. And you know, it's kind of owned us the last couple of years. So bitter, don't like them. There's a historical factor. And like you said, with the Ravens, I mean, there's the whole Ray Lewis thing. Don't really like him. So it's a tough one, man. But I think because of Jonathan Goodwin alone, I think I'm going 49ers. But I think most Saints fans don't want to hear that. I feel like most Saints fans are probably pulling for the Ravens.
Yeah, I think so. I think so, too. The thing is, and I said this in my column for WWL, Ray Lewis bothers me because he was convicted of obstruction of justice in that murder trial, and you could say whatever you want. I think he was heavily involved in that murder that happened in Atlanta, and I don't like – I mean, Tim Tebow, people knock him because he talks about God this and God that, but at least he walks the walk. It's not his fault that ESPN thinks he's a quarterback and covers him as such, but Ray Lewis – he talks about God and this and that, and he's on a journey, but he doesn't walk the walk. And it just bothers me because I think it's all a big freaking act with Ray Lewis.
Oh, I mean, he's constantly calling attention to himself and overly dramatic. I mean, him crying during the national anthem yesterday. It's just a farce. I mean, it was just so absurd for him to be, you know. I mean, it was just stupid. And he knew the camera was on him, and he's playing it up. And so I can't stand Ray Lewis. But as far as who I think is going to win the game, I mean, I think this is a fantastic matchup. I think it's two teams with maybe slightly above average quarterbacks, but that's about it. You know, the 49ers, Smith back for the Ravens was so fast. I mean, terrific field stretcher, and then they got Anquan, who is a nice possession receiver, and Pitta, the tight end, really coming along. And they're right. I mean, their offense goes through Ray Rice. 49ers, same thing. Offense goes through Frank Gore. Both defenses are elite. I think the 49ers defense is slightly better, slightly faster, slightly more aggressive. But I was not impressed with the way they played against the Falcons. And they picked it up in the second half, but Julio Jones and really Roddy White, too, embarrassed their secondary pretty badly. So if Flacco gets hot, that could affect them. So I don't know, but I think San Francisco maybe has a slight edge because I still think their defense is a little bit better, and I think they have a quarterback that's just a little bit more explosive than Kaepernick than Flacco is. So I think I give the edge to the 49ers, but I do think it's going to be a really good game because at the end of the day, it's two teams that play very good defense and run the ball well. So I think this is going to be a little bit of a throwback game, Ralph, and I like that.
Yeah.
That physical smash mouth football. They might throw some wrinkles in there, a long pass to Smith for the Ravens is the bread and butter. And the 49ers, you know, it's kind of that option read game with Kaepernick. So, you know, they're going to have some explosive plays and some things that will happen that will surprise us. But when the game comes down to the wire, you're going to see two physical, powerful football teams with big offensive and defensive lines that dominate the trenches. And these are two teams that are built the same way. So I like that there's kind of going to be that style that kind of homogeneous game where both teams are trying to do the same thing. It's going to come down to which one does it better.
Yeah, and the thing I like about Baltimore is I love Torrey Smith, and I tweeted it that, you know, if I could have one player off of all the teams from yesterday and just take them and put them on the Saints, it might be him. And I know you're probably thinking defense, defense, defense. But to me, Andrew, yeah, if you put Torrey Smith on the Saints, he's like Devery Henderson and Robert Meacham, but better. He runs better routes and he's got better ball skills, I think. I think you put him on the Saints offense would be a freak show and unstoppable. Because Flacco's not that accurate. You know, Flacco will hit Torrey Smith for every four times he's open deep. Flacco will maybe hit him twice.
Yeah, he doesn't have a great deep ball. Yeah. I mean, he hits him. Yeah.
And I just think Drew Brees, I mean, with Torrey, it would just be fantastic. But anyway, everybody, go to SaintsNation.com, read his stuff. Of course, he's going to have draft stuff. He's going to have offseason. And it'll be here before you know it. You know, because once the season ends, you got Senior Bowl, you got all that stuff, and it really, the NFL nowadays, Andrew, it doesn't really stop until the draft is done, you know?
Yeah, no, you're right. And hey, Ralph, when we, our next podcast, can it be at midnight after the Super Bowl? So it's the official Sean Payton party?
Yeah, we could. What we should do is we should get some bar to sponsor it, and we should go to New Orleans, and we should set up in the parking lot of the Saints training facility.
But I'm in.
All right, for Andrew Juge, I'm Ralph Marlborough. Thanks, and we'll see you next week.